Om sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishvahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi. Om, very good. Welcome back. Welcome also to the many students attending this class online. We continue our study of this, the penultimate chapter of Uddhava Gita. And our topic here is Bhava Roga. I'm not sure if I used that term last week or not, but it's very descriptive. We speak about many kinds of roga in life. Roga, of course, means illness. We have so many kinds of illness. We have viruses, we have bacteria, we have all kinds of problems of the body. Well, there's one kind of problem that no doctor can cure. One kind of problem, interesting, no guru can cure. I mean that. The only one who can cure this bhava roga is you. Bhava means worldly life. Refers to the suffering of worldly life. The guru can help you a lot, but ultimately you're the one who has to make the discovery of your true nature as Satchidananda. Anyway, that's not really our topic here, but how to deal with this bhava roga is the topic. And the verse that you see here, the verse, please. Yeah. This verse that you see here is the last verse we saw last week, describes the problem of treating the symptoms of an illness and not the root cause, so it comes back again and again and again. So this is a very common problem, to treat the symptoms and not the cause. I still remember an incident when I was a young man. I had chronic headaches. So I went, and after seeing seeing one doctor, I saw a neurologist. Actually, a very nice man. A neurologist was one of my students back then. This would be in maybe 1990s. And he arranged. He got an MRI done for me, no problem. And then he says, "Yeah, I don't know what the cause of the headache is, but take this; it'll help." And so I took it. He prescribed what doctors call a beta blocker. I don't know a lot about how it works, but this much I know. I took the beta blocker, and it was amazing. Overnight, the headaches went away. Seriously. 2 weeks later, they were back. The very nice doctor told me, "Okay, that's normal. You're on a very small dose. Double your dose." Wonderful, the headaches went away. 2 weeks later, that's right. So, it took me a while to figure out this wasn't the solution. Another doctor figured out what the problem was. But clearly, the beta blocker was addressing the symptom and not the underlying cause of my headaches. The underlying cause ended up not being a big deal anyway. So, this is something we're all familiar with, this problem. It also happens in spiritual life. Suppose you want to get rid of suffering and sadness, and you discover that meditating makes your suffering go away. Wonderful. So you meditate, 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 and all the suffering goes away. And then meditation comes to an end, and it comes back. So what do? Meditate, meditate, meditate. It's the same cycle. And here, Sri Krishna, in the last verse, he describes the Ku Yogi. ku, as you may or may not know, is a prefix which suggests something bad or defective. And a ku yogi is a, can't really say a bad or defective yogi, but it means a yogi who is kind of doing the wrong thing. And in this case, the wrong thing is to just keep meditating and keep meditating and keep meditating. Meditation addresses the symptoms. And nicely, how wonderful you feel when your mind becomes quiet during meditation. Whatever suffering or discomfort you felt prior to meditation, it's gone. Unfortunately, shortly after meditation, those bad feelings can come back very easily and sometimes very rapidly. So clearly, the strategy of addressing the symptoms of bhavaroga, the problem is clear. We have to address the underlying cause. And while we're on this point, let's make sure that we all understand, according to Vedanta, what is the underlying cause for suffering. And we say in a single word, ignorance, but that takes some understanding in what sense. Ignorance not in a general sense at all, but rather ignorance in the form of, to use my guru's word, self non-recognition. Failure to discover your true nature as Satchidananda Atma. Many scriptures will refer to that problem in terms of a so-called veil of ignorance covering the inner self, preventing you from discovering your true nature as Satchidananda Atma. When that veil of ignorance is removed, when self non-recognition is removed, the fundamental problem is removed in such a way that even when you're not meditating, you're okay. If you're meditating, you're okay. If you're not meditating, you're okay. This is the goal. This is the result of addressing the fundamental problem. So we have Sri Krishna here is not done talking about our ku yogi, and he continues in the next in the next verse to describe the problem. So why is this yogi merely addressing the symptoms? We'll see. And these lines are in the longer meter once again. Yogino ye vihitantararaihi, yogino ye vihitantarayair, manushya bhutais tridashopasrishtehe, manushya bhutais tridashopasrishtehe, te praktana bhyasabalena bhuyo, te praktana bhyasapsinupuyo yunjanti yogam natu karma tantram, yunjanti yogam natu karma tantram. So ye kuyoginaha, those who are such yogis, yogis who merely practice meditation. By the way, there are plenty of spiritual teachers who claim all you have to do is meditate, and they give you a special technique to meditate. Obviously, Sri Krishna doesn't agree at all with such an approach. Meditation is crucial, no doubt. It's not the ultimate solution. So why are these yogis then continually focused on doing this meditation? Actually, something we missed in a prior verse. Allow me to go back. I don't want to confuse you, but very nice word. The very last word, that yogi is described as sarva sangam. He has attachment to everything. This yogi has attachment, and in particular, this yogi has attachment to a mind that's free from suffering. That's it. The yogi, this may shake you up. The yogi has an attachment to meditation. Yeah. The yogi is attached to his or her spiritual practice. This is attachment. They do it and they feel good. If they don't do it, they don't feel good. So therefore they do it. Isn't that attachment? What is driving the yogi to meditate? They want to feel good. How different is that from someone who goes out to a nice restaurant for a meal? Why do they do that? They want to enjoy the nice meal. Someone who prepares their bed very nicely at night so they sleep well. Why do they do that? They want to rest comfortably. How different is that worldly orientation from that of this yogi who is seeking? The only difference is that in the world, you seek happiness. Let me make this point very clearly. The worldly person and this ku yogi are seeking the same thing, exactly the same thing. They're seeking contentment, peace, happiness, whatever word you like to use. I think contentment is helpful here. They're both seeking contentment. What is the difference? The worldly person seeks it outside. The yogi seeks it inside. That's the only difference. So, why does the worldly person seek outside? They're attached to feeling content. So for the sake of feeling contentment, they go to their favorite restaurant. The yogi also is attached to the mental state of contentment. This is actually an extremely important observation. When we get attached to an inner state of contentment. And some of you are thinking right now, oh, wait a minute. Isn't the enlightened person always content? The enlightened person who is Satchitananda Atma, consciousness never gets disturbed. Consciousness doesn't have to become content. The consciousness, which is the essential nature of an enlightened person, is already content and enjoys unshakable contentment. Notice that term, unshakable contentment. However, the enlightened person's mind does not enjoy unshakable contentment. The enlightened person's mind can get... What does this mean? I have no idea. Can get agitated. Let's take that word. The enlightened person's mind can get agitated. Really? Absolutely. You know, many of you have heard me tell the story of my own guru, who is on his way to teach a class, and he's obviously disturbed. I asked him what's wrong. He just got off the phone with someone in India who informed him that a dear friend has just perished in an automobile accident. 1 minute later, I see him looking disturbed. He walks into the classroom. He gives a brilliant class. He comes out, and he's fine. Was his mind disturbed? Yes. Absolutely. Could you imagine an enlightened person getting his phone call? Your dear friend has just died. Okay. Not possible, right? Where's the compassion? Where's the empathy, the love, the feelings? His mind was disturbed. Then why do you say he is enlightened? Because he didn't care about the mind being disturbed. He knew, and here's the key point, he knew that the disturbance of the mind is just another ripple that comes and goes. He knew that the disturbance of his mind was like a dark cloud in front of the sun, which would shortly disappear. He knew that when the cloud is in front of the sun isn't affected in the same way. When the mind is disturbed, consciousness is not affected. The contentment of consciousness, which is your true nature, cannot be disturbed, cannot be shaken. This is a common confusion about the goal of spiritual life. So many people wrongly consider that perfect contentment applies to your mind. No mind is capable of perfection. Is your physical body capable of perfection? Obviously not. Then why should your mind be capable of a state of perfection? Not happening. It's totally impossible. It's a wrong assumption that enlightenment is reached when your mind is perfectly content. It's a wrong assumption, and it's a common assumption, which is why I've set aside the text and I'm going ahead on going along on this topic for a little bit. It's a real common problem for spiritual seekers, one that I also suffered from. Who doesn't? I suffered from, meaning again, a story, a few of you may have heard me tell this story, and that is towards the end of our three-year course. So Pooja Swamiji, we lived with him for 3 years and studied very intense program of meditation and scriptural study. And towards the end, I was so frustrated. And I went and saw him personally, and I asked him, Swamiji, when is my mind going to permanently abide in the truth of these teachings? You see my mistake? I had a false expectation. And his answer, this is typical Pooja Swami Dayananda. So I said, Swamiji, when will my mind perfectly abide in the truth of these teachings? And when will I have reached the goal? And then his answer was simply, when you stop worrying about your mind so much. It's like hypochondria, worrying about your body so much. This is mental hypochondria. I don't know if that's a thing or not, but you get the point. It's being obsessively concerned about the state of your mind. Does that sound like a common issue? And not just for spiritual seekers, for everyone. To be obsessively concerned with the spiritual, with the condition of your mind. And naturally, you're going to be concerned about the condition of your mind because it affects everything you experience, right? If your mind is in a bad mood, that affects everything throughout the day. Right? My gosh. So it's pretty important what's happening in the mind. Absolutely true. But what is the solution? Now we're back to Bhavaroga. So if you want a mind that never becomes sad or disturbed, what can you do? And that's a trick question. On the other hand, if you want to know that you are perfectly okay in spite of the condition of your mind, that's the key. So if if your body has a cold or some temporary illness, you know, it comes and goes. Your mind is in a bad mood or it's agitated, it comes and goes. To know that you are okay in spite of the problems of the body, in spite of the problems of the mind, there lies the solution to Bhavaroga. To know that you're okay no matter what. And that discovery is made, and that conclusion is arrived at. You are okay no matter what. When you discover that you are truly Satchidananda Atma, no one can argue Satchidananda Atma is okay no matter what. Absolutely true. Regardless of the condition of the body and mind. However, most people have yet to discover that they are okay no matter what. Therefore, the condition of the body is a big deal. Therefore, the condition of the mind is a big deal. And that's true not only for other people, that was even true for our yogi, who was attached to there's actually a term. I'm thinking Dhyana Ananda, but there's something not quite right with that. The Ananda, the happiness that comes with Dhyana, not quite the right term. I don't remember in the yogic teachings, they go very technical about all this stuff. I don't remember the Sanskrit term, but to seek inner bliss. Another common stereotype gets blown out of the water. Enlightenment is gaining this bliss. And we've discussed this many times. Any bliss you experience belongs to your mind, right? Because you are the experiencer. If you are the experiencer and bliss is experienced, clearly that bliss belongs to your mind, and I guarantee you what goes up must come crashing. Absolutely, and it's the same thing. If you attain vasana. It dhyana vasana, I think that's closer to it. It is this desire for the bliss of meditation. Vasana comes in the word. And I still don't get it quite right. That's okay. But my English here describes it accurately, and that is attachment to the blissful state of mind you enjoy towards in meditation. It's another attachment, which is why the last word of this prior verse is sarva sangam. It is one of many kinds of attachment. Instead of being attached to things outside, our ku yogi is attached to things inside. And now let's get back to the verse now. So ku yogi naha ye, why are such sadhakas, ku yogis. What is it that differentiates a sadhaka who, sadhaka means spiritual aspirant, one who gains enlightenment because bhavaroga is being properly treated versus this ku yogi who is merely treating the symptoms? Why are these ku yogis on the wrong path? And the answer Sri Krishna gives here is vihita antarayaihi, because they have antaraya obstacles, impediments which are vihita, which are established maybe by karma. Actually, he goes on saying, where do these obstacles come from? He says some of the obstacles come from manushya bhutaihi, from people. Some of the obstacles come from people. Think of this yogi meditating. In fact, this happened to me in India several times. I would sit, in fact, many times. I would sit in my guru's ashram meditating. Very nice, early morning, meditating. How nice. And you can hear the Ganga off in the distance. And then in the next ashram over, they have these loudspeakers which start blaring their morning puja. And you hear this priest, Om Gnananda Ganapati. Sorry to make it sound silly, but in the middle of my meditation. And this goes on commonly in India. I used to have a dream that one day I'll have a little cottage up in a mountain someplace in India, and how nice that will be for meditation. And that dream got shattered when I realized that whatever little cottage is up on the mountainside, next to that cottage is a farm. And this is, you know, Himalayas. This is Uttarakhand. So next to the cottage is in a rural area surrounded by farmers. These farmers are out there doing whatever they do, and they all love to listen to Bollywood music while they're, while they're working. So any dream I had of this cottage up on a hillside got shattered, because where will you go in India where it's perfectly silent? Forget it. This is actually, oddly enough, it's easier to find that silence in this country than it is in India. That's just the way it works. So some of the problems for this yogi are caused by manushya bhutai, caused by people. So the farmer playing his Bollywood music and interrupting this yogi. What is this yogi seeking? That blissful meditation. And with all this noise going on outside, that's definitely a huge impediment for this yogi. And also problems which are tridasha upasrishtaihi. A little obscure. Upasrishtaihi is not obscure. It means created. Due to things being created by what? Tridasha. And it's really unclear what it means, because it's an idiom. Tridasha could mean 13, 3 and 10. It could mean 30. But there's an idiom where it means 33. It doesn't mean 33. But idiomatically, it refers to the 33 gods of ancient times. So in many scriptures, they speak of 33 fundamental deities, or gods. So these 33 gods rule the universe and then represent the dispensation of your karma. Through these 33 gods, you get the results of your karma. So going back to that word vihita, this ku yogi is unsuccessful in meditating because he is constantly interrupted either by farmers playing Bollywood music or interrupted by some kind of karma. So many obstacles that will prevent this yogi from enjoying perfect, uninterrupted mental contentment. Notice that adjective, mental. No mind can achieve that state of perfection. Then, why does this yogi continue doing this? Sadly, this yogi didn't have the right guru, and that's a very common problem. So if your guru says, all you have to do is this practice. By the way, if not just a guru, if anyone tells you all you have to do is this, doesn't that expression, all you have to do, isn't that a red flag? When somebody says, all you have to do, they're oversimplifying, whatever it is, they're oversimplifying it. There's nothing in life that is so simple that all you have to do is this or that or the other thing. Life is complicated. So you have to meditate, but meditation is not all you have to do. So if a guru says all you have to do is meditate on this or that or whatever it is, it's not proper guidance. Sadly, this Kuyogi had such a guru, was put on the wrong path. But then the yogi continues. Day after day. In spite of the fact that every time the yogi gets a quiet mind and enjoys that contentment, then meditation is over and all the headaches come back, what does the yogi do? More meditation. And more and more and more. That's what's discussed here in the second half. Let's see that. He says, Te, those kuyogis, praktana abhyasa balena bhuyaha yunjanti yogam. Bhuyaha, again and again, constantly, yunjanti yogam. They practice here yoga means meditation. They practice meditation again and again. Why? Praktana abhyasa balena. Due to the bala, the strength of their praktana abhyasa, their prior practice. Means habit. That's what it means, right? Praktana abhyasa balena is describing a habit. The strength of your prior practice, that is, when you do the same thing over and over and over again, it gets habitual. When it becomes habitual, you're likely to do it more. When you do it more, the habit becomes more deeply ingrained. This is how habits are born. So, but let's be clear, not all habits are bad habits, right? You have a habit of bathing every day. Thank goodness. That's a good habit. A habit of brushing your teeth. Many of our habits are good. We're focused on the bad habits because they cause harm, but many habits are good. So this yogi has a good habit. Meditating is good, but it's not enough. It's treating the symptom. So this yogi has fallen into this habitual behavior of seeking contentment inside. The worldly person seeks contentment outside. This yogi seeks contentment inside. The enlightened person doesn't seek contentment, knowing that Atma doesn't need anything. Atma, one's true self, is okay in spite of the dis-ease of the body, in spite of the discontent of the mind. As long as you have a human body, you're subject to disease. As long as you have a mind, you are subject to discontent and all other mental problems. The solution, then, is to recognize your true nature, and that is solving the problem of bhavaroga and not treating the symptoms. This is a problem. So that yogi goes on, natu karma tantram. That yogi doesn't get involved in conventional worldly life. So in conventional worldly life, you go to the restaurant for contentment. So the yogi isn't doing that. But the yogi is still driven, and this is another important point. Comes out actually in the next verse. One thing in common about the person who goes to the restaurant and the yogi who meditates, they're both driven by raga dvesha. Is it not so? The worldly person has raga, a compelling desire to go to that restaurant and enjoy a meal. This yogi has a compelling desire to have a to enjoy the bliss of contentment. The yogi has dvesha, wants to avoid the discontentment of the mind. Sri Krishna talks about this more in the next verse. Karoti karma kriyate cha jantuhu. Karoti karma kriyate cha jantuhu. Kenapyasau choditam chanipatam. Chodita anipatam. Natatra vidvan prakritau stitopi. Natatra vidvan prakritau stitopi. Nivritta trishna. Swasukhanu bhutya. Nivritta trishna. Swasukhanu bhutya. Jantuhu, at the end of the first line, a person. A person, karoti, karma, does actions. Those actions, kriyate, are done. Why are they done? Because that person in the second line, middle, is chodita, compelled. Sounds like raga dvesha. Ah, that person is compelled. Asau choditaha. That person is compelled. Kena api, by one thing or another. You want to get, you, again, our definition of raga is a compulsive need to get what you want, a compulsive need to avoid what you don't want. It's a compulsivity that defines it as raga dvesha, as opposed to a simple preference. If you prefer one thing over another, that's fine. You can have that. Yetike, yebitike. When you have that attitude that this is okay, that is also okay, that's a preference. But raga dvesha is not like that. I don't know, my Hindi is not there. How would you say only? Ye only TK. Sirf. Ye sirf TK. Ye bhi nahi TK. That's the idea. That's raga dvesha. When only one thing is acceptable and nothing else is acceptable. That's raga dvesha as opposed to a preference. So this person is chodita, is compelled, impelled by all this raga dvesha, and that includes our Mr. Yogi, Ku Yogi. And it continues how long? This is grim. Anipatat. A means until. Nipata is the last time you fall over, death. So anipatat, until you die. The person who's caught up in raga dvesha will continue seeking, seeking, seeking until they die. This yogi, who unfortunately has not been given proper instruction, will go on meditating, meditating, meditating until he dies. It is a very sad observation. But fortunately, Sri Krishna shines a ray of light here. Natatra vidwan. That is not true for the vidwan. Vidwan here doesn't mean a scholarly person. It means an enlightened person. That's our context. So this is not true for an enlightened person. Prakritau stitaha api. Api, even while This enlightened person is stitaha, established prakritau in prakriti. This is prakriti. This is nature. So established in a body. While that enlightened person is living, the enlightened person is not compelled by one thing after another, after another, after another. This is the subtle problem of life, when you say everything will be fine when. Right? You've said that, right? Everything will be okay when I get over this. So that probably started back in your college days, right? Everything will be okay when I pass these exams. Everything will be okay when I get this degree. Then it becomes everything will be okay when I get a job. Everything will be okay when I get married. Everything will be okay. Everything will be okay when the children are married and settled. Right? Does it stop there? Then you find something else. Everything will be okay when? Everything will be okay then. When will everything be okay? This is my old joke. When will everything be okay and you can finally rest in peace? That's when. All right. So, Vidwan Natatra, this enlightened person does not have this problem. Why? The enlightened person is Nivritta Trishnaha, is not driven by desires. Trishna, desire, Nivritta, have been removed. The enlightened person is no longer driven by Raga Dvesha. Why? Sva Sukha Anubhutya. Please don't misunderstand this. Anubhutya, due to the experience of swa-sukha, of the sukha which is swa, your own true nature. Please note that the word anubhuti here is used figuratively. Come on, we have to deal with language, right? And language is frequently used figuratively. Anyone who takes a literal interpretation of any scripture is doomed to confusion. And this is true of biblical scholars. It's equally true of Vedantic scholars. Do you think the ancient rishis were really fussy about being literal, or were they more concerned about poetically describing their fullness and completeness? They weren't grammar teachers. They weren't hung up on grammar and syntax and precision of expression. You get my point. The scriptures are poetry. All of this is poetry. So be ready for figurative expressions like anubhuti, the experience of swa sukha, of the sukha, which is your innate nature. Why is that figurative? Because if you are having the anubhuti means experience. If you are having the experience, how do you have the experience of your own sukha? See the problem? Whatever you experience is separate from you. But here, swasukha, the innate fullness, when we say Satchit Ananda, the word Ananda refers to this, swasukha. You are in your own innate nature as being full, complete, content, unshakably content. Can you experience yourself? Okay, that's how simple it is. So therefore, anubhuti here is a figurative usage. So don't have any confusion about that. So what it means, however, is an enlightened person knows or appreciates his or her true nature as Satchidananda Atma, even when there's a problem in the body, even when there's a problem in the mind, even when there's a problem at home or at work, or there's a problem with the wedding arrangements. How's that one? That ends up being a big problem for many people. So anyway, the enlightened person, as I said, okay, no matter what. Having discovered that true source of the true nature, which is innately content and perfect. Or will we end? Let's see this next verse. Tishtantam asinamuta vrajantam tishtantam asinamuta vrajantam shayanamukshantam adantamannam shayanamukshantam adantamannam swabhavamanyat kimapihamanam swabhavamanyat kimapihamanam Atmanamatma stamatirnaveda. By the way, I pause when I'm chanting, not because I don't know how to read. I pause because I can only read words. And if I don't get the word, I pause. Okay. Atmastha matihi. We'll get to that. Actually, we'll start in that last line. Atmastha matihi. One who has the mati, one who has the understanding, an understanding which is atmastha, abiding in oneself. Describing the enlightened person, the one who knows, I am Satchitananda Atma, and Satchitananda, as Satchitananda Atma, I am utterly unaffected by all the problems of the body, mind, and anything outside. That's what we're talking about. Atmastha Matihi, this enlightened person, Veda, knows. What does he know? He knows that you have to go to the third line end. Ihamanam na atmanam. We have to connect these words. The na before Veda, the atmanam. So this enlightened person, Veda, knows what? Ihamanam na atmanam. Ihamanam usually means desiring. Here it means doing, because that's the context of the verse. So the enlightened person knows that activities do not belong to Atma. I need to introduce this. This is actually a new topic, but we won't be able to develop it. So let's go back to our yogi so we get a good connection. Is meditation a karma or not? Manasa karma, right? It's mental action, mental effort, mental work. All right? So how much work you have to do depends on the goal you seek. If you have a small goal, little bit of work. Big goal, lots more work. What is our yogi seeking? Uninterrupted contentment. Perfect contentment. How much effort will it take to reach a state of contentment? That's such a significant... This is a very common teaching of Sri Shankaracharya, not only him, but he focused on this quite a bit. He says, through a limited effort, how can you achieve the limitless? How silly. And the example you've heard me give before is how much time should you spend in the gym if you want a perfect body? You get it. It doesn't work. How about this one? How much therapy should you undergo if you want a perfect mind? Same thing. How much meditation should you do if you want unshakable contentment? All of these strategies are highly flawed. There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you need to do. The enlightened person is one who has disconnected himself or herself from all of this action. The enlightened person knows tell me, who wants a perfect? This is, I'm not being sarcastic. Who is it that wants physical perfection? Does the body say, "I want to be perfect"? No, you do, right? Who wants mental perfection? Does your mind say, "I want mental perfection"? No, you do. Who is that you? The individual you, the unenlightened you. The unenlightened you can want uninterrupted contentment, a state of perfection from the mind, a state of perfection in the mind. Tell me, this is tricky, does Atma want uninterrupted contentment? Atma doesn't want anything. What can Atma do to produce uninterrupted contentment? Atma can't do anything. Atma is the pure consciousness that makes your body and mind work, but consciousness itself doesn't do anything. In the presence of consciousness, you are a sentient being. But consciousness doesn't think, consciousness doesn't walk, consciousness doesn't talk. And this is exactly what Sri Krishna says here about the enlightened person. That enlightened person, atmastam, atmasta matihi, the enlightened person who is established in the truth of oneself, knows, Veda knows, atmanam na ihamanam. Atmanam, one's true self, na ihamanam, is not engaged in activity. And here we got a long list. Go up to the first line. Atma is not engaged in activity, tishtantam, even when you're standing. So when I stand in front of the altar, you all stand up. Atma stands up? No, you, the individual person, stand up, not Atma. And then when I come and sit down here, you also sit down. Asinam. Atma doesn't stand up, Atma doesn't sit down. Uta or vrajantam, wandering around after class. You walk out, Atma doesn't walk into the classroom, Atma doesn't walk out. Shayanam. Tonight, when you're sleepy, Atma lays down in your bed? I don't think so. Body lays down. Tomorrow morning, ukshantam, you bathe. Atma bathes. Atma doesn't need bathing. Always pure. Your body needs it. And also, adantam, annam. After bathing, you have breakfast. Annam. And adantam, you're eating breakfast. All of these activities, which are swabhavam, anyat, and any, swabhavam, anyat, api. Any other activity like these, which are all natural to the unenlightened person. When you stand up, you say, "I stood." When you sit down, you say, "I sat." The enlightened person has a little different take on that. The enlightened person can still use the language, "I stood and I sat," but inside it looks real different to the enlightened person. The enlightened person sees himself or herself as the conscious observer of a body and mind standing up, a body and mind sitting down. An enlightened person knows that actions belong to the body and mind, and actions do not belong to oneself. This is the first of several verses on this particular topic. We'll stop here, but when we meet last time, we'll continue to talk about how the enlightened person with the body and mind, how they can be utterly free from action in spite of the actions of body and mind. We'll see that next time. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have our Vedanta class at 10 o'clock, followed by Satsanga, question and answer, at 11. Come and join us, please. We'll conclude with our prayers. Om Gananaham Tva Ganapatigam Vamahe Kavingavinam Upamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspatahana Shranvan Utibhisira Sadhanam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Gururhatmeti Murti Bhedavibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanuramardhanam Devaki Paramhanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Gurum Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhad Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Hamratangamaya Om Shanti 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 Om Tat Sat.